Blood of the Fold by Terry Goodkind. Copyright 1996 by Terry Goodkind and performance copyright 1999 by Brilliance Corporation. All rights reserved. Acknowledgements. Many thanks, as ever, to all those who have helped. My editor, James Frankel, for the adept way he keeps raising the bar. My British editor, Caroline Oakley, and the good people at Orion for their devotion to excellence. James Minns for the great line. Linda Quinton and the sales and marketing staff at Tor for their passion and triumphs. Tom Doherty for his faith, the knowledge of which keeps me working hard. Kevin Murphy for the award-winning cover art. Jerry for her forbearance. And I thank the spirit of Richard and Kalen, who continue to inspire me. To Anne Hansen, the light in the darkness. Blood of the Fold. Chapter 1. At the exact same instant, the six women suddenly awoke, the lingering sound of their screams echoing around the cramped officer's cabin. In the darkness, Sister Eulysia could hear the others gasping to catch their breath. She swallowed, trying to slow her own panting, and immediately winced at the raw pain in her throat. She could feel wetness on her eyelids, but her lips were so dry she had to lick them for fear they would crack and bleed. Someone was banging on the door. She was aware of his shouts only as a dull drone in her head. She didn't bother trying to focus on the words or their meaning. The man was inconsequential. Lifting a trembling hand toward the center of the coal-black quarters, she released a flow of her Han, the essence of life and spirit, directing a point of heat into the oil lamp she knew to be hanging on the low beam. Its wick obediently sprang to flame, releasing a sinuous line of soot that traced the lamp's slow to-and-fro sway as the ship rolled in the sea. The other women, all of them naked as she was, were sitting up as well, their eyes fixed on the feeble yellow glow, as if seeking from it salvation, or perhaps reassurance that they were still alive and there was light to be seen. A tear rolled down Ulysses' cheek, too, at the sight of the flame. The blackness had been suffocating, like a great weight of damp black earth shoveled over her. Her bedding was sodden and cold with sweat, but even without the sweat, everything was always wet in the salt air, to say nothing of the spray that sporadically drenched the deck and trickled into everything below. She couldn't remember what it was like to feel dry clothes or bedding against her. She hated the ship, its interminable damp, its foul smells, and the constant rolling and pitching that turned her stomach. At least she was alive to hate the ship. Gingerly, she swallowed back the taste of bile. Eulysia wiped her fingers at the warm wetness over her eyes and held out her hand. Her fingertips glistened with blood. As if emboldened by her example, some of the others cautiously did the same. Each of them had bloody scratches on their eyelids, eyebrows, and cheeks from trying desperately but futilely to claw their eyes open, to wake themselves from the snare of sleep, in a vain attempt to escape the dream that was not a dream. Eulysia struggled to clear the fog from her mind. It must have been a simple nightmare. She forced herself to look away from the flame at the other women. Sister Tovey hunched in a lower bunk opposite, the thick rolls of flesh at her sides seeming to sag in sympathy with the morose expression on her wrinkled face, as she watched the lamp. Sister Cecilia's habitually tidy, curly gray hair stood out in disarray, her incessant smile replaced by an ashen mask of fear as she stared up from the lower bunk next to Tovey. Leaning forward a bit, Eulysia glanced at the bunk above. Sister Armina, not nearly as old as Tovey or Cecilia, but closer to Eulysia's age and still attractive, appeared haggard. With shaking fingers, the usually staid Armina wiped the blood from her eyelids. Across the confining walkway in the bunks above Tovey and Cecilia sat the two youngest and most self-possessed sisters. Ragged scratches marred the flawless skin of Sister Nikki's cheeks. Strands of her blonde hair stuck to the tears, sweat, and blood on her face. Sister Marissa, equally beautiful, clutched a blanket to her naked breast, not in modesty, but in shuddering dread. Her long, dark hair was a tangled mat. The others were older, and adeptly wielded power tempered in the forge of experience, but both Nikki and Marissa were possessed of rare, innate, dark talents, a deft touch that no amount of experience could invoke. Astute beyond their years, neither was beguiled by Cecilia or Toby's kindly smiles or gentle affectations. Though young and self-assured, they both knew that Cecilia, Tovey, Armina, and especially Eulysia herself were capable of taking them both apart piece by piece if they so chose. Still, that did not diminish their mastery. In their own right, they were two of the most formidable women ever to have drawn breath. But it was for their singular resolve to prevail that the Keeper had selected them. Seeing these women she knew so well in such a state was unnerving, but it was the sight of Marissa's unbridled terror that really shook Ulyssia. She had never known a sister as composed, as unemotional, as implacable, as merciless as Marissa. Sister Marissa had a heart of black ice. Ulyssia had known Marissa for close to 170 years, and in all that time she could not recall having ever seen her cry. She was sobbing now. Sister Ulyssia drew strength from seeing the others in a condition of such abject weakness, and in fact it pleased her. She was their leader, and stronger than they. The man was still banging at the door, wanting to know what the trouble was, what the screaming was all about. She unleashed her anger toward the door.
"Leave us! If you are needed, you will be summoned!"
The sailor's muffled curses faded away as he retreated down the passageway. The only sound, other than the creak of timbers as the ship yawed when struck abeam by a heavy sea, was the sobbing.
"Stop your sniveling, Marissa," Ulyssia snapped.
Marissa's dark eyes, still glazed with fear, focused on her.
"It's never been like that before."
Toby and Cecilia nodded their agreement.
"I've done his bidding. Why has he done this? I have not failed him."
"Had we failed him," Ulyssia said,
"we would be there, with Sister Liliana."
Armina started.
"You saw her too? She was..."
"I saw her," Ulyssia said, masking her own horror with an even tone. Sister Nikki drew a twisted skein of sodden blonde hair back off her face. Gathering composure smoothed her voice.
"Sister Liliana failed the master."
Sister Marissa, the glaze in her eyes ebbing, flashed a look of cool disdain.
"She is paying the price of failure."
The crisp edge in her own tone thickened like winter's frost on a window.
"Forever."
Marissa almost never let emotion touch her smooth features, but it touched her face now as her brows drew together in a murderous scowl.
"She countermanded your orders, Sister Ulyssia, and the Keeper's. She ruined our plans. This is her fault."
Liliana had indeed failed the Keeper. They wouldn't all be on this cursed ship if it weren't for Sister Liliana. Ulyssia's face heated at the thought of that woman's arrogance. Liliana had thought to have the glory to herself. She had gotten what she deserved. Even so, Ulyssia swallowed at the memory of having seen Liliana's torment, and didn't even notice the pain of her raw throat this time.
"But what of us?" Cecilia asked.
Her smile returned, apologetic rather than merry.
"Must we do as this man says?"
Ulyssia wiped a hand across her face. They had no time to hesitate if this was real, if what she had seen had really happened. It must be nothing more than a simple nightmare. No one but the Keeper had ever before come to her in the dream that was not a dream. Yes, it had to be just a nightmare. Ulyssia watched a roach crawl into the chamber pot. Her gaze suddenly rose.
"This man? You did not see the Keeper? You saw a man?"
Cecilia quailed.
"Jagang!"
Toby raised her hand toward her lips to kiss her ring finger, an ancient gesture beseeching the Creator's protection. It was an old habit, begun the first morning of a novice's training. Each of them had learned to do it every morning without fail upon arising and in times of tribulation. Toby had probably done it by rote countless thousands of times, as had they all. A sister of the light was symbolically betrothed to the Creator and his will. Kissing the ring finger was a ritual renewal of that betrothal. There was no telling what the act of kissing that finger would do now, in view of their betrayal. Superstition had it that it was death for one who had pledged her soul to the Keeper, a sister of the dark, to kiss that finger. While it was unclear whether it truly would invoke the Creator's wrath, there was no doubt it would invoke the Keeper's. When her hand was halfway to her lips, Toby realized what she was about to do and snatched it away.
"You all saw Jagang?"
Ulyssia regarded each in turn, and each nodded. A small flame of hope still flickered in her.
"So, you saw the Emperor? That means nothing."
She leaned toward Toby.
"Did you hear him say anything?"
Toby drew the coverlet up to her chin.
"We were all there, as we always are when the Keeper seeks us. We sat in the semicircle, naked, as we always do. But it was Jagang who came, not the Master."
A soft sob came from Armina in the bunk above.
"Silence!"
Ulyssia turned her attention to the shivering Toby.
"But what did he say? What were his words?"
Toby's gaze sought the floor.
"He said our souls were his now. He said we were his now, and we lived only at his whim. He said we must come to him at once, or we would envy Sister Liliana's fate."
She looked up into Ulyssia's eyes.
He said we would regret it if we made him wait. Tears flooded her eyes. And then he gave me a taste of what it would mean to displease him.
Ulyssia's flesh had gone cold, and she realized that she, too, had drawn her sheet up. She pushed it back into her lap with an effort.
Armina?
Soft confirmation came from above.
Cecilia?
Cecilia nodded. Ulyssia looked to the two in the upper bunk opposite. The composure they had worked so hard to bring back seemed to have settled in.
Well, did you two hear the same words?
Yes, Nikki said.
The exact same, Marissa said without emotion. Liliana has brought this upon us.
Perhaps the Keeper is displeased with us, Cecilia offered, and has given us to the Emperor so we may serve him as a way of earning back our place of favor.
Marissa's back stiffened. Her eyes were a window into her frozen heart.
I have given my sole oath to the Keeper. If we must serve this vulgar beast in order to return to our master's graces, then I will serve. I will lick this man's feet if I must.
Ulyssia remembered Jagang, just before he had departed the semicircle in the dream that was not a dream, commanding Marissa to stand. He then casually reached out, grabbed her right breast in his powerful fingers, and squeezed until her knees buckled. Ulyssia glanced at Marissa's breast now and saw lurid bruises there. Marissa made no effort to cover herself as her serene expression settled on Ulyssia's eyes.
The Emperor said we would regret it if we made him wait.
Ulyssia, too, had heard the same instructions. Jagang had displayed what bordered on contempt for the Keeper. How was he able to supplant the Keeper in the dream that was not a dream? He had. That was all that mattered. It had happened to all of them. It had not been a mere dream. Tingling dread thickened in the pit of her stomach, as the small flame of hope extinguished. She, too, had been given a taste of what disobedience would mean. The blood that was crusting over her eyes reminded her of how much she had wanted to escape that lesson. It had been real, and they all knew it. They had no choice. There wasn't a moment to lose. A cold bead of sweat trickled down between her breasts. If they were late... Ulyssia bounded out of bed.
"Turn this ship around!"
she shrieked as she flung open the door.
"Turn it around at once!"
No one was in the passageway. She sprang up the companionway, screaming as she went. The others raced after her, pounding on cabin doors as they followed. Ulyssia didn't bother with the doors. It was the helmsman who pointed the ship where it was going and commanded the deckhands to the sails. Ulyssia heaved open the hatch door to be greeted by murky light. Dawn was not yet upon them. Leaden clouds seethed above the dark cauldron of the sea. Luminous foam frothed just beyond the rail as the ship slid down a towering wave, making it seem they were plunging into an inky chasm. The other sisters poured from the hatchway behind her out onto the spray-swept deck.
"Turn this ship around!"
she screamed to the barefoot sailors who turned in mute surprise. Ulyssia growled a curse and raced aft toward the tiller. The five sisters followed on her heels as she dashed across the pitching deck. Hands gripping the lapels of his coat, the helmsman stretched his neck to see what the trouble was. Lantern light came through the opening at his feet, showing the faces of the four men manning the tiller. Sailors gathered near the bearded helmsman and stood gawking at the six women. Ulyssia gulped air, trying to catch her breath.
"What's the matter with you slack-jawed idiots? Didn't you hear me? I said to turn this ship around."
Suddenly, she fathomed the reason for the stares. The six of them were naked. Marissa stepped up beside her, standing tall and aloof, as if she were dressed in a gown that covered her from neck to deck. One of the leering deckhands spoke as his gaze played over the younger woman.
Well, looks like the ladies have come out to play.
Cool and unattainable, Marissa regarded his lecherous grin with unruffled authority.
What's mine is mine, and not anyone else's, even to look upon, unless I decide it is so. Remove your eyes from my flesh at once, or have them removed.
Had the man the gift, and Ulyssia's mastery of it, he would have been able to sense the air about Marissa cracking ominously with power. These men knew them only as wealthy nobility, wanting passage to strange and distant places. They didn't know who or what the six women really were. Captain Blake knew them as Sisters of the Light, but Ulyssia had ordered him to keep that knowledge from his men. The man mocked Marissa with a lecherous expression and obscene thrusts of his hips.
"Don't be standoffish, lass. You wouldn't have come out here like that unless you had in mind the same as us."
The air sizzled around Marissa. Blood blossomed at the crotch of the man's trousers. He squealed as he looked up with eyes gone wild. Lightning glinted off the long knife at his belt as he yanked it free. Yelling an oath of retribution, he staggered ahead with lethal intent. A distant smile touched Marissa's full lips.
"You filthy scum," she murmured to herself. "I deliver you into the cold embrace of my master."
His flesh burst apart as if he were a rotten melon whacked with a stick. A concussion of air driven by the power of the gift slammed him over the rail. A bloody trail traced his course across the planks. With scarcely a splash, the black water swallowed the body. The other men, near to a dozen, stood wide-eyed and still as statues.
"You will all keep your eyes on our faces," Marissa hissed, "and off everything else."
The men nodded, too appalled to voice their consent. One man's gaze involuntarily flicked down at her body, as if her speaking aloud what was forbidden to look upon had made the impulse to view it impossible to control. In ragged terror, he began to apologize, but a focused line of power as sharp as a battle axe sliced across his eyes. He tumbled out over the rail as head the first.
"Marissa," Ulyssia said softly, "that will be quite enough. I think they've learned their lesson."
Eyes of ice, distant behind the gaze of Han, turned to her.
"I will not have their eyes taking what does not belong to them."
Ulyssia lifted an eyebrow.
"We need them to get back. You do remember our urgency, don't you?"
Marissa glanced at the men, as if surveying bugs beneath her boots.
"Of course, sister. We must return at once."
Ulyssia turned to see that Captain Blake had just arrived, and was standing behind them, his mouth agape.
"Turn this ship around, Captain," Ulyssia said. "At once."
His tongue darted out to wet his lips as his gaze skipped among the women's eyes.
"Now you're wanting to go back? Why?"
Ulyssia lifted a finger in his direction.
"You were paid well, Captain, to take us where we want to go, when we want to go. I told you before that questions were not part of the bargain, and I also promised you that I would separate you from your hide if you violated any part of that bargain. If you test me, you will find that I am not nearly as indulgent as Marissa here. I don't grant a quick death. Now turn this ship around."
Captain Blake leaped into action. He straightened his coat and glared at his men.
"Back to it, you sluggards!"
He gestured to the helmsman.
"Mr. Dempsey, bring her about."
The man seemed to be still frozen in shock.
"Right bloody now, Mr. Dempsey."
Snatching his scruffy hat from his head, Captain Blake bowed to Ulyssia, careful not to let his gaze stray from her eyes.
"As you wish, sister. Back around the Great Barrier to the Old World."
"Set a direct course, Captain. Time is of the essence."
He squashed his hat in a fist.
"Direct course? We can't be sailing through the Great Barrier."
He immediately softened his tone.
"It's not possible. We'll all be killed."
Ulyssia pressed a hand over the burning pang in her stomach.
"The Great Barrier is down, Captain. It is no longer a hindrance to us. Set a direct course."
He wrung his hat.
"The Great Barrier is down? That's impossible. What makes you think?"
She leaned toward him.
"Again, you would question me?"
No, sister. No, of course not. If you say the barrier is down, then it is. Though I don't understand how what cannot happen has happened. I know it's not my place to question. A direct course it is."
He wiped his hat across his mouth.
"Merciful Creator, protect us,"
he muttered, turning to the helmsman, anxious to retreat from her glare.
"Hard a starboard, Mr. Dempsey."
The man glanced down at the men on the tiller.
"Hard a starboard, boys."
He carefully raised his eyes and asked,
"Are you sure about this, Captain?"
"Don't argue with me, or I'll let you swim back."
"Aye, Captain." "Get to the lines,"
he shouted at men already slipping some lines and hauling in on others.
"Prepare to come about."
Ulyssia surveyed the men, glancing nervously over their shoulders.
"Sisters of the Light have eyes in the backs of their heads, gentlemen. See that yours look nowhere else, or it will be the last thing you see in this life."
Men nodded before bending to their tasks. Back in their crowded cabin, Tovey wrapped her shivering bulk in her coverlet.
"It's been quite a while since I had strapping young men leering at me,"
she glanced to Nikki and Marissa.
"Enjoy the admiration while you're still worthy of it."
Marissa pulled her shift from the chest in the end of the cabin.
"It wasn't you they were leering at."
A motherly smile wrinkled Cecilia's face.
"We know that, sister. I think what Sister Tovey means is that now that we're away from the spell of the Palace of the Prophets, we will age like everyone else. You won't have the years to enjoy your looks as we've had."
Marissa straightened.
"When we earn back our place of honor with the Master,
I will be able to keep what I have.
Toby stared off with a rare, dangerous look.
And I want back what I once had.
Armina slumped down on a bunk.
This is Liliana's fault. If not for her, we wouldn't have had to leave the palace and its spell. If not for her, the Keeper wouldn't have given Jagang dominion over us. We wouldn't have lost the Master's favor.
They were all silent for a moment. Squeezing around and past one another, they all went about pulling on their undergarments while trying to avoid elbows. Marissa drew her shift over her head.
I intend to do whatever is necessary to serve and regain the Master's favor. I intend to have my reward for my oath.
She glanced to Tovey.
I intend to remain young. We all want the same thing, sister,
Cecilia said as she stuffed her arms through the sleeves of her simple brown kirtle.
But the Keeper wishes us to serve this man Jagang for now.
Does he?
Ulyssia asked. Marissa squatted as she sorted through the clothes in the chest and pulled out her crimson dress.
Why else would we have been given to this man?
Ulyssia lifted an eyebrow.
Given? You think so?
I think it's more than that. I think Emperor Jagang is acting of his own volition.
The others halted at their dressing and looked up.
You think he could defy the Keeper?
Nikki asked.
For his own ambitions?
With a finger, Ulyssia tapped the side of Nikki's head.
Think. The Keeper failed to come to us in the dream that is not a dream. That has never happened before. Ever. Instead comes Jagang. Even if the Keeper were displeased with us and wanted us to serve penance under Jagang, don't you suppose he would have come to us himself and ordered it, to show us his displeasure? I don't think this is the Keeper's doing. I think it is Jagang's.
Armina snatched up her blue dress. It was a shade lighter than Ulyssia's, but no less elaborate.
It is still Liliana who has brought this upon us.
A small smile touched Ulyssia's lips.
Has she? Liliana was greedy. I think the Keeper thought to use that greed, but she failed him.
The smile vanished.
It is not Sister Liliana who brought this upon us.
Nikki's hand paused as she drew the cord tight at the bodice of her black dress.
Of course. The boy.
Boy?
Ulyssia slowly shook her head.
No boy could have brought down the barrier. No mere boy could have brought to ruin the plans we have worked so hard for all these years. We all know what he is, about the prophecies.
Ulyssia looked at each sister in turn.
We are in a very dangerous position. We must work to gain back the Keeper's power in this world, or else when Jagang is finished with us, he will kill us, and we will find ourselves in the underworld and no longer of use to the Master. If that happens, then the Keeper surely will be displeased, and he will make what Jagang showed us seem a lover's embrace.
The ship creaked and groaned as they all considered her words. They were racing back to serve a man who would use them and then discard them without a thought, much less a reward. Yet none of them were prepared to even consider defying him.
Boy or not, he has caused all this.
The muscles in Marissa's jaw tightened.
And to think, I had him in my grasp. We all did. We should have taken him when we had the chance. Liliana, too, thought to take him, to have his power for herself,
Ulyssia said.
But she was reckless and ended up with that cursed sword of his through her heart. We must be smarter than she. Then we will have his power and the Keeper his soul.
Armina wiped a tear from her lower eyelid.
But in the meantime, there must be some way we can avoid having to return. And how long do you think we can remain awake?
Ulyssia snapped.
Sooner or later we would fall asleep. Then what? Jagang has already shown us he has the power to reach out to us wherever we are.
Marissa returned to fastening the buttons at the bodice of her crimson dress.
We will do what we must for now, but that does not mean we can't use our heads.
Ulyssia's brows drew together in thought. She looked up with a wry smile.
Emperor Jagang may believe he has us where he wants us, but we've lived a long time. Perhaps if we use our heads and our experience, we will not be quite as cowed as he thinks.
Malevolence gleamed in Toby's eyes.
Yes, she hissed. We have indeed lived a long time, and we've learned to bring a few wild boars to ground and gut them while they squeal.
Nikki smoothed the gathers in the skirt of her black dress.
Gutting pigs is all well and good,
But Emperor Jagang is our plight and not its cause. Nor is it advantageous to waste our anger on Liliana. She was simply a greedy fool. It is the one who truly brought this trouble upon us who must be made to suffer.
Wisely put, sister, Ulyssia said.
Marissa absently touched her breast where it was bruised.
I will bathe in that young man's blood.
Her eyes went out of focus, opening again the window to her black heart.
While he watches.
Ulyssia's fists tightened as she nodded in agreement.
It is he, the Seeker, who has brought this upon us. I vow he will pay with his gift, his life, and his soul.
Chapter 2 Richard had just taken a spoonful of hot spice soup when he heard the deep, menacing growl. He frowned over at Gratch. The Gar's hooded eyes glowed, lit from within by cold green fire, as he glared toward the gloom among the columns at the base of the expansive steps. His leathery lips drew back in a snarl, exposing prodigious fangs. Richard realized he still had a mouthful of soup and swallowed. Gratch's guttural growl grew, deep in his throat, sounding like a moldy old castle's massive dungeon door being opened for the first time in 100 years. Richard glanced to Mistress Sanderholt's wide brown eyes. Mistress Sanderholt, the head cook at the Confessor's Palace, was still uneasy about Gratch and not entirely confident in Richard's assurances that the Gar was harmless. The ominous growl wasn't helping. She had brought Richard out a loaf of freshly baked bread and a bowl of savory spice soup, intending to sit on the steps with him and talk about Kaelin, only to discover that the Gar had arrived a short time before. Despite her trepidation over the Gar, Richard had managed to convince her to join him on the steps. Gratch had been keenly interested at the mention of Kaelin's name. He had a lock of her hair that Richard had given him hanging on a thong around his neck, along with the dragon's tooth. Richard had told Gratch that he and Kaelin were in love, and she wanted to be Gratch's friend, just as Richard was. And so the inquisitive Gar had sat down to listen. But just as Richard had tasted the soup and before Mistress Sanderholt had been able to begin, Gratch's mood had suddenly changed. He looked savagely intent now on something that Richard couldn't see.
"Why is he doing that?"
Mistress Sanderholt whispered.
"I'm not sure," Richard admitted.
He brightened his smile and shrugged offhandedly when the creases in her brow deepened.
"He must just see a rabbit or something. Gars have exceptional eyesight, even in the dark, and they're excellent hunters."
Her concerned expression didn't ease, so he went on.
"He doesn't eat people. He would never hurt anyone," he reassured her.
"It's all right, Mistress Sanderholt, really it is." Richard glanced up at the sinister-looking, snarling face.
"Gratch," he whispered, out of the side of his mouth. "Stop growling, you're scaring her."
"Richard," she said as she leaned closer. "Gars are dangerous beasts. They are not pets. Gars can't be trusted."
"Gratch isn't a pet. He's my friend. I've known him since he was a pup, since he was half my size. He's as gentle as a kitten."
An unconvincing smile twitched onto Mistress Sanderholt's face.
"If you say so, Richard."
Dismay suddenly widened her eyes.
"He doesn't understand anything I'm saying, does he?"
"It's hard to tell," Richard confided. "Sometimes he understands more than I think possible."
Gratch appeared oblivious of them as they talked. He was frozen in concentration, seeming to have either the scent or the sight of something he didn't like. Richard thought he had seen Gratch growling like that one time before, but he couldn't place where or when. He tried to recall the occasion, but the mental image kept slipping away just out of grasp. The harder he tried, the more elusive the shadowy memory became.
"Gratch," he clutched the Gar's powerful arm. "Gratch, what is it?"
Stone still, Gratch didn't react to the touch. As he had grown, the glow in his green eyes had intensified, but never before to this ferocity. They were glowing brightly. Richard scanned the shadows below, where those green eyes were fixed, but saw nothing out of the ordinary. There were no people among the columns or along the wall of the palace grounds. "It must be a rabbit," he decided at last. Gratch loved rabbit. Dawn was just beginning to reveal wisps of purple and pink clouds above the brightening horizon, leaving but a few of the brightest stars to glimmer in the western sky. With the faint first light came a gentle breeze, unusually warm for winter, that ruffled the fur of the huge beast and billowed open Richard's black wrist-width cape. When he had been in the old world with the Sisters of the Light, Richard had gone into the Hagen Woods, where lurked the wrist-width, vile creatures looking like men half-melted into a reptilian nightmare. After he had fought and killed one of the Mriswith, He had discovered the astonishing thing its cape could do. It had the ability to blend with its background so perfectly, so flawlessly, that it made the Mriswith, or Richard, when he concentrated while wearing the cape, seem invisible. It also prevented anyone with the gift from sensing them, or him. For some reason, though, Richard's own gift allowed him to sense the presence of the Mriswith. That ability to sense the danger despite its cloak of magic had saved his life. Richard found it difficult to focus on Gratch's growling at rabbits in the shadows. The anguish, the numb misery of believing that his beloved Kaelin had been executed, had evaporated in a heart-pounding instant the day before when he had discovered she was alive. He felt blind joy that she was safe, and exultant at having spent the night alone with her in a strange place between worlds. His mind was in song this beautiful morning, and he found himself smiling without even realizing it. Not even Gratch's annoying fixation with the rabbit could dampen his mood. Richard did find the guttural sound distracting, though, and obviously Mistress Sanderholt found it alarming. She sat woodenly on the edge of a step beside him, clutching her wool shawl tight.
"Quiet, Gratch. You just had a whole leg of mutton and half a loaf of bread. You couldn't be that hungry already."
Although Gratch's attention remained riveted, his growling lessened to a rumbling deep in his throat, as if he was absently trying to comply. Richard directed a brief glance once more toward the city. His plan had been to find a horse and hurry on his way to catch up with Kaelin and his grandfather and old friend, Zed. Besides being impatient to see Kaelin, he dearly missed Zed. It had been 3 months since he had seen him, but it seemed years. Zed was a wizard of the First Order, and there was much that Richard, in light of his discoveries about himself, needed to talk to him about. But then Mistress Sanderholt had brought out the soup and freshly baked bread. Good mood or not, he had been famished. Richard glanced back past the white elegance of the Confessor's Palace, up at the immense, imposing Wizard's Keep, embedded in the steep mountainside, its soaring walls of dark stone, its ramparts, bastions, towers, connecting passageways and bridges, all looking like a sinister incrustation growing from the stone, somehow looking alive, as if it were peering down at him from above. A wide ribbon of road wound its way up from the city toward the dark walls, crossing a bridge that looked thin and delicate, but only because of the distance, before passing under a spiked drop gate and being swallowed into the dark maw of the keep. There had to be thousands of rooms in the keep, if there was one. Richard snugged his cape closer under the cold, stony gaze of that place and looked away. This was the palace, the city, where Kaelin had grown up, where she had lived most of her life until the previous summer, when she had crossed the boundary to Westland in search of Zed, and had come across Richard, too. The Wizard's Keep was where Zed had grown up and lived prior to leaving the Midlands, before Richard was born. Kaelin had told him stories about how she had spent much of her time in the keep, studying, but she had never made the place sound in the least bit sinister. Hard against the mountain, the keep looked baleful to him now. Richard's smile returned at the thought of how Kaelin must have looked when she was a little girl, a confessor in training, strolling the halls of this palace, walking the corridors of the keep, among wizards, and out among the people of the city. But Adendrill had fallen under the blight of the Imperial Order, and was no longer a free city, no longer the seat of power in the Midlands. Zed had produced one of his wizard's tricks, magic, to make everyone think they had witnessed Kaelin's beheading, allowing them to flee Adendrill while everyone here thought she was dead. No one would chase after them now. Mistress Sanderholt had known Kaelin since she was born, and was delirious with relief when Richard told her that Kaelin was safe and well. The smile touched his lips again. "What was Kaelin like when she was little?" She stared off, a smile on her lips as well.
"She was always serious, but as precious a child as I've ever seen, who grew to be a stalwart and beautiful woman. She was a child not only touched by magic, but also of a special character. None of the confessors were surprised by her accession to Mother Confessor, and all were pleased because her way was to facilitate agreement, not to dominate. Though if someone wrongly opposed her, they'd find her cast with as much iron as any Mother Confessor ever born. I've never known a confessor with her passion for the people of the Midlands. I've always felt honored to know her."
Drifting into memories, she laughed faintly, a sound not nearly as frail as the rest of her appeared.
"Even one time when I swatted her bottom after I discovered she had made off with a just roasted duck without asking."
Richard grinned at the prospect of hearing a story about Kaelin misbehaving.
Punishing a confessor, even a young one, didn't give you pause?
No, she scoffed. Had I pampered her, her mother would have turned me out. We were expected to treat her respectfully but fairly.
Did she cry? He asked, before he took a big bite of bread. It was delicious, coarse ground wheat with a hint of molasses.
No. She looked surprised. She believed she had done no wrong, and started explaining. Apparently a woman with two young ones, almost Kaelin's age, had been waiting outside the palace for someone she thought would be gullible. As Kaelin started for the wizard's keep, the woman approached her with a sad story, telling her that she needed gold to feed her youngsters. Kaelin told her to wait, and then took her my roasted duck, reasoning that it was food the woman needed, not gold. Kaelin set the children down. With a bandaged hand, she pointed off to her left, around that side over there, and fed them the duck. The woman was furious and started yelling, accusing Kaelin of being selfish with all the palace's gold. As Kaelin was telling me the story, a patrol of the home guard came into the kitchen dragging the woman and her two young ones along. Apparently, as the woman had been railing at Kaelin, the guard had come upon the scene. About this time, Kaelin's mother showed up in the kitchen, wanting to know what the trouble was. Kaelin told her story, and the woman fell to pieces at being in the custody of the home guard, and worse, at finding herself before the mother confessor herself. Kaelin's mother listened to her story, and to the woman's, and then told Kaelin that if you chose to help someone, then they became your responsibility, and it was your duty to see the help through until they were back on their own feet. Kaelin spent the next day on King's Row, with the home guard, dragging the woman behind, going from one palace to another, looking for one that was in need of help. She wasn't having much luck. They all knew the woman was a sot. I felt guilty about giving Kaelin a swat before, at least hearing her reasons for taking my roasted duck. I had a friend, a stern woman in charge of the cooks at one of the palaces, and so I rushed over and convinced her to accept the woman into her employ when Kaelin brought her around. I never told Kaelin what I'd done. The woman worked there a long time, but she never again came near the confessor's palace. Her youngest grew up to join the home guard. Last summer, he was wounded when the Daharans captured Aiden Drill and died a week later. Richard, too, had fought Dahara, and in the end had killed its ruler, Darkin Rall, though he still couldn't help feeling a twinge of regret at being sired by that evil man. He no longer felt the guilt of being his son. He knew that the crimes of the father didn't pass on to the child, and it certainly wasn't his mother's fault she had been raped by Darkin Rall. His stepfather loved Richard's mother no less for it, nor did he show Richard any less love for not having been his own blood. Richard would not have loved his stepfather any less had he known George Cypher was not his real father. Richard was a wizard, too, he now knew. The gift, the force of magic within him called Han, had been passed down from two lines of wizards. Zed, his grandfather on his mother's side, and Darkin Rall, his father. That combination had spawned in him magic no wizard had possessed in thousands of years, not only additive, but also subtractive magic. Richard knew precious little about being a wizard or about magic, but Zed would help him learn, help him control the gift, and use it to aid people. Richard swallowed the bread he had been chewing.
That sounds like the Kaelin I know. Mistress Sanderholt shook her head ruefully.
She always felt a deep responsibility for the people of the Midlands. I know it hurt her to her very soul to have them turn against her for the promise of gold.
Not all did that, I'd bet, Richard said. But that's why you mustn't tell anyone she's still alive. In order to keep Kaelin safe and protect her, no one must know the truth.
You know you have my promise, Richard.
But I expect they've forgotten about her by now. I expect that if they don't get the gold they were promised, they'll soon be rioting. So that's why all those people are gathered outside the confessor's palace? She nodded.
They now believe they're entitled to it, because someone from the Imperial Order said that they were to have it.
Though the man who promised it is now dead, it's as if once his words were spoken aloud, the gold magically became theirs. If the Imperial Order doesn't soon begin handing out the gold in the treasury, I imagine it won't be long before those people in the streets decide to storm the palace and take it.
Maybe the promise was only made as a diversion, and the troops of the Order intended all along to keep the gold for themselves as plunder, and will defend the palace.
Perhaps you're right, she stared off.
Come to think of it,
I don't even know what I'm still doing here. I'm of no mind to see the Order set up quarters in the palace. I'm of no mind to end up working for them. Maybe I should leave and see if I couldn't find a place to work where people are still free of that lot. It seems so strange to think of doing that, though. The palace has been my home for most of my life. Richard looked away from the white splendor of the Confessor's palace, out over the city again. Should he flee, too, and leave the ancestral home of the Confessors and the Wizards to the Imperial Order? But how could he do anything about it? Besides, the Order's troops were probably searching for him. Best if he slipped away while they were still confused and disorganized after the death of their council. He didn't know what Mistress Sanderholtz should do, but he should be going before the Order found him. He needed to get to Kaelin and Zed. Gratch's growl deepened into a primal rumble that rattled Richard's bones and brought him out of his thoughts. The Gar rose smoothly to his feet. Richard scanned the area below again, but saw nothing. The Confessor's palace sat on a hill with a commanding view of Adendril, and from his vantage point he could see that there were troops beyond the walls in the streets of the city, but none were close to the three of them in the secluded side courtyard outside the kitchen entrance. There was nothing alive in sight where Gratch was watching. Richard stood, his fingers briefly finding reassurance on the hilt of his sword. He was bigger than most men, but the Gar towered over him. Though little more than a youngster for a Gar, Gratch stood close to 7 feet, Richard guessing his weight at half again his own. Gratch had another foot to grow, maybe more. Richard was far from an expert on short-tailed Gars. He had not seen that many, and the ones he had seen had been trying to kill him at the time. Richard, in fact, had killed Gratch's mother in self-defense, and had inadvertently ended up adopting the little orphan. Over time, they had become fast friends. Muscles under the pink skin of the powerfully built beast's stomach and chest knotted in rippling bulges. He stood still and tensed, his claws poised out to his sides, his hairy ears perked toward things unseen. Even in taking prey when he was hungry, Gratch had never displayed this level of intent ferocity. Richard felt the hackles on the back of his neck rising. He wished he could remember when or where it was he had seen Gratch growling like this. He finally put aside his pleasant thoughts of Kaelin, and with mounting urgency focused his attention. Mistress Sanderholt stood beside him, peering nervously from Gratch to where he was looking. Thin and frail-looking, she was not a timid woman by any means, but had her hands not been bandaged, he thought she would be wringing them. She looked as if she wanted to. Richard suddenly felt quite exposed on the open, wide sweep of steps. His keen gray eyes scrutinized the murky shadows and concealed places among the columns, walls, and assortment of elegant belvederes spread across the lower parts of the palace grounds. Sparkling snow lifted on an occasional ripple of wind, but nothing else moved. He stared so hard it made his eyes hurt, but he saw nothing alive, no sign of any threat. Though he saw nothing, Richard began to feel a burgeoning sense of danger. Not a simple reaction from seeing Gratch so riled, but welling up from within himself, from his Han, welling from the depths of his chest, coursing into the fibers of his muscles, drawing them tight and ready. The magic within had become another sense that often warned him when his other senses did not. He realized that that was what was warning him now. An urge to run, before it was too late, gnawed deep in his gut. He needed to get to Kaelin. He didn't want to get tangled in any trouble. He could find a horse and just go. Better yet, he could run now and find a horse later. Gratch's wings unfolded as he crouched in a menacing posture, ready to launch into the air. His lips drew back further, vapor hissing from between his fangs as the growl deepened, vibrating the air. The flesh on Richard's arms tingled. His breathing quickened as the palpable sense of danger coalesced into points of threat. "Mr. Sanderholt," he said as his gaze skipped from one long shadow to another. "Why don't you go inside? I'll come in and talk to you after." His words caught in his throat as he saw a brief movement down among the white columns, a shimmer to the air, like the heat rippling the air above a fire. He stared, trying to decide if he had really seen it or just imagined it. He frantically tried to think of what it could be, if indeed he had seen something. It could have been a wisp of snow carried on a brief gust of wind. He didn't see anything as he squinted in concentration. It was probably nothing more than the snow and the wind, he tried to assure himself. Abruptly, the manifest realization welled up within him, like cold black water surging up through a rift in river ice. Richard remembered when it was he had heard Gratch growl like that. The fine hairs on the back of his neck stood out like icy needles in his flesh. He His hand found the wire-wound hilt of his sword.
Go, he whispered urgently to Mistress Sander Holt. Now!
Without hesitation, she dashed up the steps and made for the distant kitchen entrance behind him as the ring of steel announced the arrival of the Sword of Truth in the crisp dawn air. How was it possible for them to be here? It wasn't possible, yet he was sure of it. He could feel them.
Dance with me, Death. I am ready,
Richard murmured, already in a trance of wrath from the magic coursing into him from the Sword of Truth. The words were not his, but came from the sword's magic, from the spirits of those who had used the weapon before him. With the words came an instinctive understanding of their meaning. It was a morning prayer, meant to say that you could die this day, so you should strive to do your best while you still lived. From the echo of other voices within came the realization that the same words also meant something altogether different. They were a battle cry. With a roar, Gratch shot into the air, his wings lifting him after only one bounding stride. Snow swirled, curling into the air under him, stirred up by the powerful strokes of his wings that also billowed open Richard's wrists with cape. Even before he could see them materialize out of the winter air, Richard could sense their presence. He could see them in his mind, even though he couldn't yet see them with his eyes. Howling in fury, Gratch descended in a streak toward the base of the steps. Near the columns, just as the Gar reached them, they began to become visible, scales and claws and capes, white against the white snow, white as pure as a child's prayer. Mriswith. Chapter 3. The Mriswith reacted to the threat, materializing as they flung themselves at the Gar. The sword's magic, its rage, inundated Richard with its full fury as he saw his friend being attacked. He bounded down the steps toward the erupting battle. Howls assailed his ears as Gratch tore into the Mriswith. In the heat of combat, they were now visible. Against the white of stone and snow, they were difficult to distinguish clearly, but Richard could see them well enough. There were close to 10, as near as he could tell in all the confusion. Under their capes, they wore simple hides as white as the rest of them. Richard had seen them black before, but he knew the Mriswith could appear to be the color of their surroundings. Taut, smooth skin covered their heads down to their necks, where it began welting up into tight, interlocking scales. Lipless mouths spread to reveal small, needle-sharp teeth. In the fists of their webbed claws, they gripped the cross members of three-bladed knives. Beady eyes, intense with loathing, fixed on the raging Gar. With fluid speed, they swept around the dark form in their midst, their white capes billowing behind as they skimmed across the snow, some tumbling under the attack or spinning out of reach, just escaping the Gar's powerful arms. With brutal efficiency, the Gar caught others on claws, ripping them open, throwing a shock of blood across the snow. So intent were they on Gratch that Richard descended upon their backs unopposed. He had never fought more than one Mriswith at a time, and that had been a formidable ordeal. But with the fury of the magic pounding through him, he thought only of helping Gratch. Before they had a chance to turn to the new threat, Richard cut down too. Shrill death howls sundered the dawn air, the sound needle-sharp and painful in his ears. Richard sensed others behind him, back toward the palace. He spun just in time to see three more abruptly appear. They were racing to join the fight, with only Mistress Sanderholt in their way. She cried out at finding her escape route blocked by the advancing creatures. She turned and ran ahead of them. Richard could see that she was going to lose the race, and he was too far away to make it in time. With a backhanded swing of his sword, Richard slashed open a scaled form that turned on him.
Gratch! He called out. Gratch!
Twisting the head off a Mriswith, Gratch looked up. Richard pointed with his sword.
Gratch, protect her!
Gratch instantly grasped the nature of Mistress Sanderholt's peril. Flinging aside the limp, headless carcass, he bounded into the air. Richard ducked. Swift strokes of the Gar's leathery wings lifted him over Richard's head and up the steps. Reaching down, Gratch snatched the woman up in his furry arms. Her feet jerked off the ground and over the sweeping knives of the Mriswith. Spreading his wings wide, Gratch banked before the woman's weight could cost him his momentum, swooped down beyond the Mriswith, and then, with a powerful stroke, broke his descent to set Mistress Sanderholt on the ground. Without pause, he sprang back into the fray, and deftly avoiding the flashing knives, struck out with his claws and fangs. Richard spun back to the three Mriswith at the base of the steps. Losing himself to the sword's rage, he became one with the magic and the spirits of those who had wielded the sword before him. Everything moved with the slow elegance of a dance, the dance with death. The three Mriswith came at him, whirling with cold grace, an onslaught of flashing blades. Pivoting, they split rank, skimming up the steps to go around him. With detached efficiency, Richard caught the lone creature on the point of his blade. To his surprise, the other two cried out,
"No!"
Astonished, Richard froze. He hadn't known that Mriswith could speak. They paused on the steps, holding him in beady, snake-like gazes. They had almost made it past him on their way up the steps toward Gratch. Intent on the gar, he surmised, they wanted most to get past him. Richard bolted up the steps, blocking their way. Again they split ranks, one going to each side. Richard feinted at the one to his left and then reeled to strike out at the other. His sword shattered the triple blades in one of its claws. Without pause, the Mriswith spun, evading the killing thrust of Richard's blade. But as the creature came around, closing the distance to deliver its own strike, he drew his sword back, slicing across its neck. With a howl, the Mriswith toppled to the ground, writhing, spilling blood across the snow. Before Richard could turn to the other, it crashed into him from behind. The two of them tumbled down the steps. His sword and one of the three-bladed knives clattered across the stone at the bottom, skittering out of reach and disappeared under the snow. They rolled over, each trying to gain the advantage. With its scaled arms constricting around his chest, the wiry beast tried to muscle Richard onto its stomach. He could feel fetid breath on the back of his neck. Though he couldn't see his sword, he could feel its magic and knew exactly where it lay. He tried to lunge for it, but the Mriswith's weight hobbled him. He tried to drag himself, but the snow-slicked stone denied him enough purchase. The sword remained out of reach. Powered by his anger, Richard staggered to his feet. Still clutching him with both scaled arms, the Mriswith slithered a leg around his. Richard crashed face first to the ground, the weight of the Mriswith on his back driving the wind from his lungs. The Mriswith's second knife hovered inches from his face. Grunting with effort, Richard pushed himself up with one arm and with the other hand seized the wrist that held the knife. In one smooth, mighty movement, he heaved the Mriswith back, ducked under the arm, and as he came back up, wrenched it around one full turn. Bone popped. With his other hand, Richard brought his belt knife to the creature's chest. The Mriswith, cape and all, flushed to a sickening, weak, greenish color.
"Who sent you?"
When it didn't answer, Richard twisted its arm, pinning it behind the beast's back.
"Who sent you?"
The Mriswith sagged.
"The Dreamwalker,"
it hissed.
"Who's the Dreamwalker? Why are you here?"
Waves of waxy yellow suffused the Mriswith. Its eyes widened as it struggled anew to escape.
"Green eyes."
A sudden blow slammed Richard back. A flash of dark fur snatched the Mriswith. Claws yanked its head back. Fangs sank into its neck. A powerful jerk ripped the throat away. Startled, Richard gasped for air. Before he could catch his breath, the gar, his green eyes wild, lunged at him. Richard threw his arms up as the huge beast smashed into him. The knife flew from his hand. The sheer size of the gar was smothering, his awesome strength overpowering. Richard might as well have been trying to hold back a mountain that was falling on him. Dripping fangs drove for his face.
"Gratch!"
He snatched fistfuls of fur.
"Gratch, it's me, Richard!"
The snarling face drew back a bit. Vapor huffed out with each breath, reeking of the putrid stench of Mriswith blood. The glowing green eyes blinked. Richard stroked the heaving chest.
"It's all right, Gratch. It's over. Calm down."
The iron-hard muscles of the arms that held him slackened. The snarl wrinkled into a grin, tears welling in his eyes. Gratch crushed Richard to his chest.
"Gratch, log, Gratchog."
Patting the gar's back, Richard struggled to get air into his lungs.
"I love you too, Gratch."
Gratch, the green gleam back in his eyes, held Richard out for a critical inspection as if to assure himself that his friend was intact. He let out a purling gurgle that bespoke his relief. Whether at finding Richard safe or at having stopped before tearing him apart, Richard wasn't sure, but he did know that he too was relieved that it was over. His muscles, the fear, anger, and fury of the fight abruptly gone from them, throbbed with a dull ache. Richard took a deep breath at the heady feeling of having survived a sudden attack, but he was unsettled by the mutability of Gratch's usual gentle disposition into such deadly ferocity. He glanced around at the startling amount of foul-smelling gore spilled across the snow. Gratch hadn't done it all. As he put down the last vestige of the magic's anger, it struck him that perhaps Gratch saw him in a similar light. Just as Richard, Gratch had risen to the threat.
"Gratch, you knew they were here, didn't you?"
Gratch nodded enthusiastically, adding a bit of a growl to make his point. It occurred to Richard that when he had last seen Gratch growling with such vehemence outside the Hagen Woods, It must have been because he sensed the presence of the Mriswith. The Sisters of the Light had told him that occasionally the Mriswith strayed from the Hagen Woods, and that no one, not Sisters of the Light, sorceresses, or even wizards, had been able to perceive their presence, or had ever survived an encounter with them. Richard had been able to sense them because he was the first in near to 3,000 years to be born with both sides of the gift. So how did Gratch know they were there?
Gratch, could you see them?
Gratch pointed to a few of the carcasses, as if to point them out for Richard.
No, I could see them now. I mean before, when I was talking to Mistress Sanderholt and you were growling. Could you see them then?
Gratch shook his head.
Could you hear them or smell them?
Gratch frowned and thought, his ears twitching, and then shook his head again.
Then how did you know they were there before we could see them?
Eyebrows as big as axe handles drew together as the huge beast frowned down at Richard. He shrugged, looking perplexed about his failure to come up with a satisfactory answer.
You mean that before you could see them, you could feel them? Something inside just told you they were there?
Gratch grinned and nodded, happy that Richard seemed to understand. That was similar to how Richard knew they were there. Before he could see them, he could sense them, see them in his mind. But Gratch didn't have the gift. How could he do it? Perhaps it was just because animals could sense things before people could. Wolves commonly knew you were there before you knew they were. Usually, the only time you knew a deer was in a thicket was when it bolted, having sensed you long before you saw it. Animals generally had keener senses than people, and predators some of the keenest. Gratch was certainly a predator. That sense seemed to have served him better than Richard's magic had him. Mistress Sanderholt, having come down to the bottom of the steps, laid a bandaged hand on Gratch's furry arm.
Gratch, thank you,
she turned to Richard, lowering her voice.
I thought he was going to kill me, too, she confided.
She glanced at several of the torn bodies.
I've seen Garz do that to people. When he snatched me up like that, I thought sure he was going to kill me. But I was wrong. He's different.
She peered back up at Gratch.
You saved my life. Thank you.
Gratch's smile showed the full length of his bloody fangs. The sight made her gasp. Richard glanced up at the sinister-looking, grinning face.
Stop smiling, Gratch. You're scaring her again.
His mouth turned down, his lips covering his prodigious, wickedly sharp fangs. His wrinkled features melted into a sulk. Gratch viewed himself as lovable and seemed to think it only natural that everyone else would, too. Mistress Sanderholt stroked the side of Gratch's arm.
It's all right. His smile is heartfelt and handsome in its own way. I'm just not used to it, that's all.
Gratch smiled at Mistress Sanderholt again, adding a sudden, spirited flapping of his wings. Unable to help herself, Mistress Sanderholt lurched back a step. She was just coming to understand that this Gar was different from those that were always a threat to people, but her instincts still ruled that understanding. Gratch made for the woman to give her a hug. Richard was sure she would die of fright before she realized the Gar's benign intent, so he put a restraining arm in front of Gratch.
He likes you, Mistress Sanderholt. He just wanted to give you a hug, that's all. But I think your thanks are enough.
She quickly regained her composure.
Nonsense.
Smiling warmly, she held her arms out.
I'd like a hug, Gratch.
Gratch gurgled with glee and scooped her up. Under his breath, Richard cautioned Gratch to be gentle. Mistress Sanderholt let out a muffled, helpless giggle. Once back on the ground, she squirmed her bony frame straight in her dress and awkwardly drew her shawl up on her shoulders. She beamed warmly.
You're right, Richard. He's no pet. He's a friend.
Gratch nodded enthusiastically, his ears twitching as he flapped his leathery wings again. Richard pulled a white cape, one that was nearly clean, off a nearby Mriswith. He asked Mistress Sanderholt's indulgence, and when she granted it, stood her before an oak door to a small, low-roofed stone building. He draped the cape around her shoulders and drew the hood up over her head.
I want you to concentrate, he told her. Concentrate on the brown of the door behind you. Hold the cape together under your chin and close your eyes if it will help you focus. Imagine you're one with the door, that you're the same color.
She frowned up at him.
Why am I to do this?
I want to see if you can appear invisible like they were.
Invisible?
Richard smiled his encouragement.
Just give it a try.
She let out a breath and finally nodded. Her eyes slowly closed. Her breathing evened and slowed. Nothing happened. Richard waited a while longer, but still nothing happened.
The cape remained white, not a stitch of it turning brown. She finally opened her eyes.
"Did I become invisible?" she asked, sounding as if she were afraid she had.
"No," Richard admitted.
"I didn't think so. But how did those vile snake men make themselves invisible?"
She shrugged the cape off her shoulders and shuddered in revulsion.
"And what made you think I could do it?"
"They're called Mriswith. It's their capes that enable them to do it, so I thought that maybe you could, too." She regarded him with a dubious expression. "Here, let me show you." Richard took her place before the door and drew up the hood of his Mriswith cape. Flipping the cape closed, he set his mind to the task. In the space of a breath, the cape became the exact same color as what she saw behind him. Richard knew that the magic of the cape, apparently with the aid of his own, somehow enveloped the exposed parts of him, too, so that he seemed to disappear. When he moved from in front of the door, the cape transfigured to continually match what she saw behind. As he stepped in front of the white stone, the pallid blocks and shadowed joints appeared to slip across him, mimicking the background as if she truly were looking through him. Richard knew from experience that even if the background was complex, it made no difference. The cape could match anything behind him. As Richard moved away, Mistress Sanderholt continued to stare at the door where she had last seen him. Gratch's eyes, however, never left him. Menace gathered in those green eyes as the Gar followed Richard's movements. A growl rose in the Gar's throat. Richard let his concentration relax. The background colors sloughed from the cape, letting it return to black as he pushed the hood back.
"It's still me, Gratch."
Mistress Sanderholt started, jerking around to discover him in his new location. Gratch's growl trailed off and his expression slackened, at first to confusion and then to a grin. He rumbled with a low gurgle of a laugh at the new game.
"Richard,"
Mistress Sanderholt stammered.
"How did you do that? How did you make yourself invisible?"
"It's the cape. It doesn't really make me invisible, but somehow it can change color to match the background, so it tricks the eye. I guess it takes magic to make the cape work, and you don't have any, but I was born with the gift, so it works for me." Richard glanced around at the fallen Mriswith. "I think it best if we burned these capes, lest they fall into the wrong hands." Richard told Gratch to fetch the capes at the top of the steps, while he bent to gather up the ones below.
"Richard, do you think it could be dangerous to use the cape from one of those evil creatures?"
"Dangerous?" Richard straightened and scratched the back of his neck. "I don't see how. All it does is change color. You know, the way some frogs and salamanders can change color to match whatever they're sitting on, like a rock or a log or a leaf." She helped him as best she could with her bandaged hands, wrap the capes into a bundle.
"I've seen those frogs. I've always thought it one of the Creator's wonders that they could do that."
She smiled up at him.
"Perhaps the Creator is blessing you with the same wonder, because you have the gift. Praise be to him. His blessing helped save us."
As Gratch held out the rest of the capes, one at a time, so she could add them to the bundle, anxiety tightened like arms around Richard's chest. He glanced up at the Gar.
"Gratch, you don't sense any more Mriswith anywhere, do you?"
The Gar handed the last cape to Mistress Sanderholt, and then peered off into the distance, searching intently. Finally, he shook his head. Richard sighed in relief.
"Do you have any idea where they came from, Gratch? Any direction in particular?"
Gratch again slowly turned around, scrutinizing the surroundings. For a dead silent moment, his attention fixed on the wizard's keep, but at last moved on. Finally, he shrugged, looking apologetic. Richard scanned the city of Aidendrill, studying the Imperial Order troops he could see below. They were made up of men of many nations, he had been told, but he recognized the chainmail, armor, and dark leather worn by most, Dharans. Richard knotted the last of the loose ends around the capes, drawing them into a tight bundle and then tossed the lot on the ground.
"What happened to your hands?"
She held them out, turning them over. The wrap of white cloth was discolored with dried smears of meat drippings, sauces, and oils, and smudged with ash and soot from the fires.
"They pulled off my fingernails with tongs to make me give witness against the Mother Confessor, against Kaelin."
"And did you?"
When she looked away, Richard flushed at realizing how his question must have sounded.
"I'm sorry, that came out wrong. Of course, no one would expect you to defy their demands under torture. The truth doesn't matter to people like that. Kaelin wouldn't believe you betrayed her."
She shrugged with one shoulder as she lowered her hands.
"I wouldn't say the things they wanted me to say about her,
She understood, just as you said. Kaelin herself ordered me to testify against her, to keep them from doing more. Still, it was misery itself to speak such lies. I was born with the gift, but I don't know how to use it, or I'd see what I could do about helping you. I'm sorry. He winced in sympathy. Is the pain beginning to ease, at least? With the Imperial Order in possession of Adendrill, I'm afraid the pain has only begun. Was it the Dharans who did this to you? No. It was a Keltish wizard who ordered it. When Kaelin escaped, she killed him. Most of the Order's troops in Adendrill are Dharans, though. How have they treated the people of the city? She rubbed her bandaged hands on her arms, as if chilled in the winter air. Richard almost put his cape around her shoulders, but, thinking better of it, helped her pull her shawl up instead. Though Dahara conquered Adendrill, autumn passed, and their troops were brutal about the fighting. Since they put down all opposition and took the city, they have not been so cruel, so long as their orders are followed. Perhaps they simply saw more value in having their prize intact.
That could be, I suppose.
What of the keep? Have they taken that, too? She glanced over her shoulder up the mountain. I'm not sure, but I don't think so. The keep is protected by spells, and from what I am told, the Dharan troops fear magic. Richard rubbed his chin and thought. What happened after the war with Dahara ended? Apparently, the Dharans, among others, made pacts with the Imperial Order. Slowly, the Keltans took charge, with the Dharans remaining most of the muscle, but acquiescing in the ruling of the city. Keltans don't fear magic the way Dharans do. Prince Fyron of Kelton and that Keltish wizard commanded the council. With the prince, the wizard, and the council now dead, I'm not sure exactly who is in charge. The Dharans, I would guess, which leaves us still at the mercy of the Imperial Order. With the Mother Confessor and the wizards gone, I fear our fate. I know she had to flee or be murdered, but yet... Her voice trailed off, so he finished for her. Since the Midlands was forged and Adendrill founded to be its heart, none but a Mother Confessor has ruled here. You know the history. Kaelin told me some of it. She's heartsick to have had to abandon Adendrill, but I assure you, we will not let the Order have Adendrill any more than we will let them have the Midlands. Mistress Sanderholt looked away in resignation. What was is no more. In time, the Order will rewrite the history of this place, and the Midlands will be forgotten. Richard, I know you are anxious to be off to join her. Find a place to live your lives in peace and freedom. Don't become bitter at what was lost. When you reach her, tell her that although there were people who cheered at what they thought was her execution, many more were desolate at hearing she was dead. In the weeks since she fled, I've seen the side she didn't see. Just as anywhere, there are evil, greedy people here. But there are good people, too, who will always remember her. Though we be subjects of the Imperial Order now, as long as we live, the memory of the Midlands will live on in our hearts. Thank you, Mistress Sanderholt. I know she'll be heartened to hear that not everyone turned against her and the Midlands. But don't give up hope. As long as the Midlands lives on in our hearts, there is hope. We will prevail. She smiled, but in the depths of her eyes he could see for the first time into the core of her despair. She didn't believe him. Life under the Order, brief as it had been brutal enough to extinguish even the spark of hope. That was why she hadn't bothered to leave Adendrail. Where was there to go? Richard retrieved his sword from the snow and wiped its gleaming blade clean on Amriswith's hide clothes. He drove the sword home into its scabbard. They both turned at the sound of nervous whispers to see a crowd of kitchen workers gathered near the top of the steps, staring incredulously at the carnage in the snow and at Gratch. One man had picked up one of the three-bladed knives and was turning it over, examining it. Fearing to come down the steps near Gratch, he insistently motioned for Mistress Sanderholt's attention. She gestured irritably, urging him to come to her. He appeared to be hunched more from a life of hard labor than from age, though his thinning hair was graying. He descended the steps with a rolling gait as if carrying a heavy sack of grain on his rounded shoulders. He bobbed a quick bow of deference to Mistress Sanderholt as his gaze flicked from her to the bodies, to Gratch, to Richard, and back again to her.
What is it, Hank?
Trouble, Mistress Sanderholt.
I'm a little busy at the moment with troubles of my own, Can't all you people pull bread from the ovens without me there? His head bobbed.
Yes, Mr. Sanderholt, but this is trouble about...
He glared at a reeking Mriswith carcass lying nearby.
About these things.
Richard straightened. What about them? Hank glanced to the sword at his hip and then diverted his eyes.
I think it was...
When he looked up at Gratch and the Gar smiled, the man lost his voice.
Hank, look at me. Richard waited until he complied. The Gar won't hurt you. These things are called Mriswith. Gratch and I are the ones who killed him. Now, tell me about the trouble.
He scrubbed the palms of his hands on his wool trousers.
I looked at their knives, at those three blades they have. That appears to be what did it.
His expression darkened.
The news is spreading on a near panic. People have been killed. Thing is, no one saw what done it. Those killed all had their bellies slit open by something with three blades.
With an anguished sigh, Richard wiped a hand across his face.
That's the way Mriswith kill. They disembowel their victims, and you can't even see them coming. Where were these people killed?
All over the city, at about the same time, right at first light. From what I heard, I reckon it had to be separate killers. By the number of these Mriswith things, I'd wager I'm right. The dead mark lines, like the spokes of a wheel, all leading here. They killed whoever was in their way, men, women, even horses. The troops are in an uproar, as some of their men got it, too, and the rest seem to think it's an attack of some sort. One of these Mriswith things went right through the crowd gathered out in the street. The bastard didn't bother to step around, just slashed his way right through the middle.
Hank cast a sorrowful glance to Mistress Sanderholt.
One came through the palace, killed a maid, two guards, and Jocelyn.
Mistress Sanderholt gasped and covered her mouth with a bandaged hand. Her eyes slid closed as she whispered a prayer.
I'm sorry, Mistress Sanderholt, but I don't think Jocelyn suffered. I got to her right away and she was already gone.
Anyone else of the kitchen staff?
Just Jocelyn. She was on an errand, not in the kitchens.
Gratch silently eyed Richard as he glanced up the mountain at the stone walls. The snow above was flushed pink in the dawn light. He pursed his lips in frustration as he looked out over the city again, bile raising in his throat.
Hank.
Sir?
Richard turned back. I want you to get some men, carry the Mriswith out in front of the palace and line them up along the grand entrance. Get it done now before they freeze solid. The muscles in his jaw stood out as he ground his teeth. Put the loose heads on pikes. Line them up nice and neat on each side, so that anyone entering the palace has to walk between them. Hank cleared his throat, as if about to protest, but then he glanced to the sword at Richard's hip and instead said,
At once, sir.
He bobbed his head to Mistress Sanderholt and rushed to the palace to get help. The Mriswith must have magic. Maybe the fear of it will at least keep the Dharans from the palace for a while. Worry lines creased her brow.
Richard, as you say, apparently these creatures had magic. Can anyone but you see these snake men when they're sneaking up, changing color?
Richard shook his head.
From what I've been told, only my unique magic can sense them. But obviously Gratch can, too.
The Imperial Order preaches on the evil of magic and those who have it. But if this dreamwalker sent the Mriswith to kill those with magic?
Sounds reasonable. What's your point?
Her expression grave, she watched him for a long moment.
Your grandfather Zed has magic, as does Kalin.
Goosebumps tingled up his arms at hearing her voice his own thoughts aloud.
I know. But I may have an idea. For now, I must do something about what's going on here, about the Order.
What can you hope to accomplish?
She took a breath and softened her tone.
I mean no offense, Richard. Though you have the gift, you are ignorant of its use. You are not a wizard. You can be of no help here. Flee while you can.
Where?
If the Mriswith can reach me here, they can reach me anywhere. There is no place to hide for long. He looked away, feeling his face heat.
I know I'm no wizard.
Then what?
He turned a raptor's glare on her.
Kalin, as the Mother Confessor, in the name of the Midlands, has committed the Midlands to war against the Order, against its tyranny. The Order's cause is to exterminate all magic and rule all people. If we do not fight, all free people and all those with magic will be murdered or enslaved. There can be no peace for the Midlands, for any land, for any free people, until the Imperial Order is crushed.
Richard, there are too many here. What can you hope to accomplish alone?
He was tired of being surprised and never knowing what was coming after him next. He was tired of being held prisoner, of being tortured, of being trained, of being lied to, of being used, of seeing helpless people slaughtered. He had to do something. Though he was no wizard, he knew wizards. Zed was only a few weeks away to the southwest. Zed would understand the need to rid Adendrill of the Imperial Order and of protecting the wizard's keep. If the Order destroyed that magic, who knew what would be lost for all time? If need be, there were others, at the Palace of the Prophets in the Old World, who might be willing and able to help. Warren was his friend, and although not fully trained, he was a wizard and knew about magic. More than Richard, anyway. Sister Verna, too, would help him. The sisters were sorceresses and had the gift, though not as powerfully as a wizard. He trusted none but Sister Verna, though. Except, perhaps, Prelate Annalena. He didn't like the way she kept information from him and bent the truth to serve her needs. But it had not been out of malevolence. She had done what she had to out of concern for the living. Yes, Anne might help him. And then there was Nathan the prophet. Nathan, living under the palace's spell for most of his life, was close to 1,000 years old. Richard couldn't even imagine what that man knew. He had known that Richard was a war wizard, the first to be born in thousands of years, and helped him to understand and accept its meaning. Nathan had helped him before, and Richard was reasonably sure he would again. Nathan was a Rawl, Richard's ancestor. Desperate thoughts churned through his mind. The aggressor makes the rules. Somehow I must change them. What are you going to do? Richard glared out at the city. I must do something they don't expect. He ran his fingers over the raised gold wire spelling out the word truth on the hilt of the sword, and at the same time felt the seething texture of its magic. I wear the sword of truth, conferred on me by a real wizard. I have a duty. I am the Seeker. In a haze of simmering rage that rose at the thought of the people murdered by the Mriswith, he whispered to himself, I vow to give this dreamwalker nightmares.
Chapter 4
My arms do be itching like ants, Lunetta complained. It be powerful here.
Tobias Brogan glanced back over his shoulder. Scraps and patches of tattered, faded cloth fluttered in the faint light as Lunetta scratched herself. Amid the ranks of men bedecked with gleaming armor and mail, draped with crimson capes, her squat form hunched atop her horse looked as if it peered out from a rag pile. Her plump cheeks dimpled with a gap-toothed grin as she chortled to herself and scratched again. Brogan's mouth twisted in disgust and he turned away, knuckling his wiry mustache as his gaze again passed over the wizard's keep. Up on the mountainside, the dark gray stone walls caught the first weak rays of the winter sun that blushed the snow on the higher slopes. His mouth tightened further.
Magic, I say, my lord general, Lunetta insisted. There be magic here, powerful magic.
She prattled on, grumbling about the way it made her skin crawl.
Be silent, you old hag. Even a half-wit wouldn't need your filthy talent to know that Adendrill sees with the taint of magic.
Feral eyes gleamed from under her fleshy brows.
This be different from any you have seen before, she said in a voice too thin for the rest of her. Different from any I have ever felt before. And some be to the southwest, too, not just here.
She scratched her forearms more vigorously as she cackled again. Brogan glowered past the throngs of people hurrying down the street, casting a critical eye at the exquisite palaces lining the wide thoroughfare called, he had been informed, King's Row.